This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
I'm here at Jikoji on I think yesterday was solstice, and today or at a real early in the morning, like maybe around midnight our time, was the eclipse, the solar eclipse on the other side of the world. And today is Father's Day, and happy Father's Day to everyone. And I want to speak a little bit to that right now. Six weeks ago was Mother's Day, and so I want to read you something that is attributed to the chief author in the Rig Veda of Mandala 7. His name was Vashita, and he writes this. This must have been written 3,000-4,000 years ago. He says, "The teacher is 10 times more venerable than the assistant teacher. The father is 100 times more venerable than the teacher. Mother is 1,000. All fathers have mothers. Of course, all mothers have mothers too. But I want to read a brief poem by Angie Boisevain, entitled "My Sons." And though not all sons become fathers, all fathers are sons. And though all sons do not become fathers, there are maybe all sons do fatherly things. But this is her poem, "My Sons." "I say, but you are no more mine than these shoes which found my feet and carry me, than this hook this book which reads me, that the pieces of sandwich which feel their way into the dark. My sons, I say, but you are the sun's son, the sea's children, offspring of the winds. And I live in you as you carry me, your burden, your problem, your little child." So, in order to do this work that we do here in Buddhist practice, not just here at Jikoji, but everywhere, I also wanted to speak a little bit about the taking of the vows of the three treasures. And I'm going to read a little from Dainin Katagiri's "The Returning to Silence." He says, "Only in taking refuge in the triple treasure can we become disciples of the Buddha. We become a child of the Buddha. Being a child of the Buddha means that we have to accept completely the universe where all sentient beings exist. There is no excuse for ignoring anything in this world. If we accept ourselves, we have to accept all sentient beings, not as something separate from our life, but as the contents of our life." He says that when we accept all things in this universe, they are the contents of our life. Examples of how others have lived in their lives are not just stories of others' lives separate from ours. Their stories are exactly the contents of our life. So very naturally, others' lives become a mirror for me, and my life becomes a mirror for others. So, in that context of when we are mirrors for others, and others are mirrors for us, there is trust, there is an acceptance of all of this. And it bodes well for how we function in this world. So, keeping this in mind that all things, all sentient beings are the contents of our life, I want to tell you a story that some may already know about an African-American musician who maintained, a bodhisattva, a living bodhisattva. I doubt that he's Buddhist, he might be, but the work that he does is bodhisattva work. And he was born in 1958 in Chicago. His name is Daryl Davis. His parents moved him to Belmont, Massachusetts in 1968, where he was one of two Black children in the school system. He was encouraged to join the Cub Scouts by his classmates, and so he went ahead and did that. And one of the big events that happened in that town was it commemorated Paul Revere's ride from Lexington to Concord. And so Boy Scouts, Cub Scouts, Girl Scouts, along this young boy, age 10, goes back home after this parade, and his parents didn't go to the parade, and they see him and they say, "Daryl, you've fallen down." And he says, "No, I did not fall down. I was hit with rocks and bottles." And his parents tended his wounds and then sat him down and told him at age 10 about racism. And he could not believe his parents. And so over the years, he began to see that his parents were correct. But at age 10, the purity of his existence, he could not understand why people would want to hurt him just because of the color of his skin. So he went on he obviously had amazing parents who embodied him in love, who even when he was at age 10 getting hit with rocks and bottles, he didn't want to strike back. He just couldn't understand what these people were doing. And there must just have been a ton of love in that home. So he went on to become a professional musician. And he ended up, at one point, this burning question in him still was there of why would people want to hurt me when they don't know who I am? And so that was one of the core questions of his life that he wanted to answer. And so he figured out the way to answer that question is to go and ask people that say they hate Black people. And so he asked his booking secretary, Mary, to make an appointment with an imperial wizard named Roger Kelly. He was a national leader in the Klan, and he lived nearby. And Daryl told his secretary, "Please don't tell him that I'm African American." So they make an appointment. This guy agrees to come, and they meet at a motel nearby. And Daryl and Mary are in this motel room, and there's a knock at the door right on time. And in walks Roger Kelly, the Imperial Wizard, and his bodyguard. And Daryl puts his hands up to show he has nothing in him, and then reaches out to shake their hands and invites them to sit down. And he sits down to ask them They were really shocked. When they first walked in the door, they were shocked to see a black man. They weren't sure what this was all about. But he said, I'm writing a book. I want to find out about the Klan. So they sat down, and right away, Roger Kelly let him know that Daryl Davis, an African-American, was not his equal. And Daryl said, okay, tell me more. And so they had this conversation. And when that partway through this conversation, there was a loud sound that happened, a foreign sound that happened. And it immediately startled everybody in the room. And Daryl knew, you know, the bodyguard had a gun. He wasn't sure if Roger Kelly had a gun. He and Mary didn't have any gun on them. And his reaction, instead of freezing or fleeing, was to stand up and get ready to fight. And when he stood up to wonder what the heck Roger Kelly had done, he looked in Roger Kelly's eyes and said nothing, but with this fierceness of, what did you do? And Roger Kelly looked back in his eyes and said, what did you do? And then Daryl looked over at the bodyguard, and the bodyguard was looking back and forth between the two men. What did you guys do? And finally, Mary says, I got soda bottles in an ice bucket, and the ice melted and the bottles connected. That's what happened. And in that moment, which could have gone really bad, where people could have been killed or hurt, you know, they all laughed and sat down and continued with their conversation. But Daryl points out, this is from a TED talk he had done, he points out that in that moment, there was this foreign sound caused fear in everyone. What comes from fear, what you fear, is you hate what you fear because you don't want what makes you afraid nearby. So you hate it. And when you hate things, you end up being destructive towards others. And so he saw in this moment where this foreign sound could have started a very ugly, bloody situation. He saw that this is really how we have to meet ignorance. And so he went on to invite Roger Kelly and his bodyguard to his house for lunch and dinner. And that happened many, many times. And over a period of years, they maintained this relationship, and Roger Kelly invited him to Klan meetings, which Davis ended up going to and sitting in the front row. And Daryl Davis would invite Roger Kelly and some of the Klansmen to hear music, hear their band play. And they were probably the only white guys in this place, but he invited them in. But after a while, this relationship continued for a long time. And CNN ended up interviewing both these guys and going to a KKK rally where Roger Kelly... he says to the Klan, and this African-American, Daryl, is standing there too, and he says, you know, he says that he respects this African-American man more than any other Klanman there. He said, the reason why is that he respects me to sit down and listen to me. And I respect him to sit down and listen to him. And so this respect to sit down and listen is what bonded these two men. And Daryl Davis ended up getting his, the Imperial Wizards Klan robe. So, you know, the sequence from ignorance to fear to hatred to destruction, you know, this is, you know, we talk about putting an end to ignorance. And it's just helpful to know where these things lead, so maybe we can unpack them and be more useful. And so how to be more useful? I really appreciated, I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago when Cynthia Keir gave her talk here. And she expressed how just amazing it is to be working with so many bodhisattvas. She just loves this life, being a bodhisattva and working with other bodhisattvas, and hopes that she can come back and do it many more times. And then Bob Sedeby, who's from Santa Barbara, he pipes in and he says, yes. And they say that when the sooner you become a bodhisattva, the longer it takes. And to me, that's a joyful thing. And I have so many times in my life felt just this ebullience of energy or something that just, I want to be alive. I want to be helpful. I want to do this again and again. I want to be a bodhisattva countless lives, because, you know, this life is a blast most of the time, right? Or maybe it's not, but it's just really good to do this kind of work. And it dawned on me that maybe what we do here at Jokoji, you know, we hope that people come and they awaken their bodhisattva in them, or they already are bodhisattvas, and this is a place of encouragement so people can just go on out and do the good thing. But wouldn't it be something, you know, we talk about saving every being until coming back to save every being until we finally achieve nirvana. Wouldn't it be something to have a world where everyone is a bodhisattva? I mean, imagine how harmonious and enriching and fun and what this place could be like when people work together and manifest what they have best. So I just encourage everybody in their bodhisattva practices, in their following the precepts, and a deep bow to Connie for leading the discussions over these many months on the precepts, Wednesday nights. So it has been so helpful. So this is the work we do to make this world a better place. I know in Buddhism we don't talk about leaving the world better than we found it. I think, I'm not sure where that notion comes from, but many of us probably were brought up with that. Maybe it is a bodhisattva notion, but that we may be able to do this. So that's what I have for today, for now, and I open it up for discussion here at Jokoji and out there in Zoom country. Any comments from anyone? Yes, Karin?
Yes, I did have a kind of a comment or a topic of discussion which might be a bit controversial, but I still wanna go ahead and ask other people's opinions. So this comes from two personal experiences I had very early on when I came to the United States. Can you guys hear me, by the way? Doug is frozen. I don't know. Doug, can you hear me? Okay. So this was like from two early experiences I had when I came to the United States. One of them was that I had just come and I was like a student and I had a bicycle, and so I spent a lot of money to buy that bicycle after saving it, and one day I came to my bike and there was this man, and his ethnicity was African American, and I saw him sawing through my lock, And I kind of forgot about it because he then ran away or just he went away. But again, my bike was stolen about an year later around the same, in a different neighborhood, but it was eventually stolen. And then there was this another incident where I was in San Francisco, and I remember this was my first night in San Francisco sometime in 2012. And we were inside the city. It was quite late in the night, and we were just hanging out, and there was like this group of young boys, and they were like these African-American boys who asked me if they could make a call because they wanted to get home. And I said, sure. And I hand my phone or I make that call for them, but it was going to a wrong number. And then we walked away, but then they came back and said, hey, can you make another call? And as I started to make that call, all of them violently attacked me, trying to steal my phone. And eventually there was like this this confrontation with them, and I was able to save my phone, but I got beaten up pretty bad. I went to the emergency room. And so I had these experiences. And so when we have this discussion on topics like these, I see that, you know, this community has gone through a lot of injustice. But then when you look at crime, and some of these people have developed prejudice against African Americans because of the crimes that they have themselves undergone, or their loved ones have undergone, then I feel that for these people, we should have empathy for African Americans for the injustice also, but then we should also have empathy for some of this other community. Because I know that like crime comes from a really bad place, because these people are really pushed to the edge, and this community is pushed to the edge, and they resort to crime. There's like all sorts of reasons are up behind somebody. Why would somebody resort to crime? But I think that but crime in itself is a really bad thing, and we should have some empathy for example, like in the story that you mentioned, Doug, that you said this boy said, why do they hate me simply for the color of my skin? And that is wrong. I think that is categorically wrong to hate somebody for the color of the skin. But it is important for us to understand that where is that prejudice coming from? Is it just coming from the fact that people think that one color of skin is superior than the other, or there might be other reasons why that prejudice is coming from? And so I just wanted to share this experience and this perspective, and I wonder what people think about it.
Yeah, thank you, Karin, for bringing this thing up. And I'm sorry for the circumstances you had to suffer through there. You know, what is the source of crime? Why do people become involved in crime? And by lack, you know, ignorance, lack of education, lack of resources, lack of, there's so many factors. And when certain peoples are targeted and they're not permitted to work and they're not provided resources for and good education, then the domains in which they function are going to be the low life ends, because that's all that's left. And this young man, this man, Daryl Davis, that I brought up, this African-American musician, he probably had educated parents. He's an educated man himself. and his children will be educated as well. And it's and so he could even be ignorant about racism up to age 10. Yet other kids, they see the lack of support and resources and love and everything. And how do you manage? You manage just with basic thuggery is basically what happens. So to attribute it to a particular race or ethnicity or nationality is a very dangerous thing to do. A lot of these things are cultural, but they're also systemic of a whole system. And I think that's what is happening in our country today, is the whole system is being examined and opened. And where suburban white mothers can feel the empathy of an African-American mother who has teenage sons, and can feel the how distraught they would be of sending their kids out when they might not ever come home. And normally white folk can't feel that, but I think there's more empathy about that today. And so how do we open it up so that you know, all people can feel the bounty that this universe provides? And I think as bodhisattvas, that's part of what we help to do, is we help, just like elementary and junior high and high school teachers, you know, to me, they are also the saints of the world that help bring knowledge and wisdom to young children and give them the essentials so they can grow and become the best that they are. Anyway, that's, I see it more systemic than just cultural.
Right, thank you. I just wanna give one more follow-up comment to your answer. And I wholeheartedly agree with everything you said there, Doug. Like my point is a subtle one. And I think like what I feel is that the source of this discrimination is twofold. One of them is there's two layers to it. I think the bottom layer is definitely the systemic injustice or the superiority that one race feels towards the other. That's definitely one of the things which is underlying all of this. But a second thing is that as a consequence of that injustice, the one race or one community is pushed to the sidelines as when they resort to things which are not right, not categorically right, and such as crime. And when the average person who probably is not does not belong to the same class, which thinks that, okay, one race is superior or inferior, but they just witness the crime, that's when they can develop prejudice, which is not coming from that same place, the place of thinking one color is superior than the other. So I feel that distinction is important to appreciate because an average person who is a white person or a brown person or a black person, they might not be they might not have the color of this, the measuring criteria for them might not be the color of their skin, of the person's skin, but the measuring criteria could be crime or behavior that they see in society. So it's important for us to appreciate that, that like in your story that you mentioned that boy Daryl was discriminated. It might not just be because people think that he's inferior, but because of the consequences of some people thinking that and the consequences that this community had to face and that resorted to crime and other things which are categorically incorrect or wrong.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, thank you, Karin. Yeah, there are so many factors that can go into what the prejudice that we show has. Yes. Yes, Kofei.
I have a cousin, you know, who's half American. I was 18 when he was born. I'm half American, half Iranian, of course, I'm Iranian. I was 18 when he was born. I literally used to babysit him and wash his diapers, literally. And he's racist. And he grew up in Las Vegas. And I asked him, you know, why do you hate blacks? And he said when he was a kid in school, he was pushed down and beat up by a black kid. And that's why he hates blacks. So I've tried to talk to him, but it's been very tough conversation because he doesn't respect my political views. What I kind of feel from what Karn said is that, so this is a perfect example. This is the illustration of what Karn was mentioning. But there's two things that happened here. First, the event happened that he was beat up by a black kid. Then the subsequent story making that all blacks are to be hated. So that generalization is where the racism comes in. You know, so I don't have any answer. I can tell you that since I was a kid, I like people. I used to get in trouble in lines with my mom shopping. I would pull on grown-ups' pants and ask to talk to them since I was a kid. So what I decided to do because of this situation is multiple times I've seen black people and either I smile at them or wave at them or I talk to them. And I've had wonderful experiences with it, a few wonderful experiences. And sometimes I've looked at them and I saw that they don't want to have any contact instantly. And I respect it and I don't approach them in that situation. But I saw, the last time was I saw, it was a young black man, his wife, partner anyway, I can't be sure if they're married, but their partner, they had four kids. Four daughters were with them on the beach. I was on the beach 3-4 days ago. And they were so loving to each other. He was holding his wife. Their daughter, one of their daughters was near them as I passed them on the beach. She was playing like kids do. And we just looked at each other. I looked at the man and his wife and we smiled at each other. And I just went like this and pointed at the daughter. And they met like this, and that was it. So I just try to acknowledge their humanity and like we're brothers and sisters. At the same time, I also have the same fears as Karin has. Sometimes so I don't have an answer, but I just feel like, you know, we have to see each other's humanity somehow, despite our fears. We have to be vulnerable enough to see each other's humanity and have, Suzuki Roshi said, with purity of heart, I vow to reveal beginner's mind.
Thank you, Kobe. Yes, the pure of heart. There's one of the things that happens in all of these situations is this fixed views we have, or views that become fixed. And the only way to make it, as we chanted in the Metta Sutra, is not holding the fixed views. And I want to read from stanza 76 of the Tao Te Ching. about a subtle mind. And he says, men are born soft and subtle. Dead, they are stiff and hard. Plants are born tender and pliant. Dead, they are brittle and dry. Thus, whoever is stiff and inflexible is a disciple of death. Whoever is soft and yielding is a disciple of life. The hand and stiff will be broken. The soft and subtle will prevail. The hard and stiff will be broken. The soft and subtle will prevail. And in this story about Daryl Davis, there was just always soft about him. When he would go to the KKK rallies, he was soft, he was open, he was curious, he was kind. And the other KKK men were kind back to him. And with this fundamental respect, it's, so how do we, I guess the soft and subtle, it takes a lot more courage and maybe fearlessness to operate well with it. But that's where the bounty of our existence shines. So I guess I want us here at Jokoji to just help make people allow people to become more and better bodhisattvas. That's our job. So if we can keep doing that, we'll be okay. Yes, Chris.
Hello, Doug.
Hello.
Sorry I missed the first part of your talk, but I am familiar with Daryl Davis's story and I've been very impressed by it. And I have some concerns. I think it's really good that we have so many people involved in fighting for justice, and some that are allowing some violence and hateful feelings to overwhelm them. I think that's probably because of the moment. I'm hoping it's something that's going to subside in favor of some healing. And we have to, someone already remarked that we have to find the humanity in one another. And I was at another sangha this morning and we were talking about Maya Angelou, and I didn't get a chance to talk. One of my favorite quotes of hers was, do the best you can until you know better.
Beautiful.
That's kind of what I got out of your talk, you know. I'm getting an echo, so I'm gonna. Let's try to find the humanity in one another and listen and try to gain understanding of one another as bodhisattvas. That I think that's the most important thing we can do. Doesn't mean you're necessarily going to agree with that person, but you can talk to them and understand better what and just experience their humanity rather than cutting them off completely as some sort of hateful, evil, whatever, which is what we tend to do in our culture. I'm glad you brought up that story because it's a very heartwarming story that people of that extreme end of the spectrum can talk to one another. Then certainly we as Buddhists and could not demonize one another just because they said something that you found it offensive, and just try to gain some understanding.
Yes. Very good. Thank you. Yes. Emmy.
I hope you can hear me okay. I was thinking about when you were talking about mothering, and I would just like to say that I think that mothering can be coming, it can be a mothering love that can come from both men and women. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't, of course, women bear children, but a woman can be mothering and a man can be mothering in a way that they can love it, more of like humanity and be giving and kind and generous and virtuous. And so I just like to point that out, that men and women, it's not just a female thing. It's a mm-hmm. universal kind of humanity, love.
Yes, yes. In parenting, nurturing happens by both, and it's not just a mothering thing. It's nurturing is nurturing, and I think, you know, I kind of feel bad about this quote that denigrates teachers. It says, you know, a teacher is 10 times not more valuable, but has. I forget what I wrote. Under my knee?
Underneath your cushion.
Well, anyway, a father is valued 100 times more than a teacher, and a mother 1,000 times more than a father. But, you know, that really denigrates teachers. And teachers, so there must have been, that was an old, old cultural idea, maybe 4,000 years ago, but I think that nurturing aspect of teachers is something that many of my cousins are teachers, and one of them just recently died. Who, you know, the obituary about him was just the bounty of love that happened in school, and he just loved being a teacher, and when teachers love their work, you know, it just infects their students, and that's huge. But thank you for pointing out that mothering or nurturing is unisexual or non-binary. Yes.
Thanks, Doug, for guiding us into this story about the musician. I'd like to return to
Can't that. Hear you.
I'd like to return to the story. About
I'll
the
repeat. He's. I'll repeat it. He wants to return to the story that, yes?
The musician and the KKK.
Okay.
Klansman, the wizard. You mentioned the first thing the Klansman said, the first communication he gave was, "You're not my equal." So that was the first.
"You are not my equal."
"You are not my equal." That was his first.
Yes, the first thing.
First communication with Beryl. And then a little bit later, something happened, and everybody in the room reacted. And they looked at each other, "Quack, quack, quack." So they were all on edge, and they all shared this moment of apprehension. And then when the facts came out that it was the bottles of soda exploding, that released the tension. But it also gave them the completion of a moment where they shared something. They shared an experience. The guy had come in there thinking, "You're not like me." But then something happened, and they were all like each other. They found mm-hmm. a common experience. They found common ground. And I think that may be a key for us in many ways mm-hmm. to relate across boundaries, across differences in our prior experiences, across differences in our skin color, whatever superficial differences there may be, we need to find commonality. Mm-hmm. That's an avenue that will lead us to a better place.
Yes, very good. John, thank you. Speaking about the situation in the motel room where the soda bottles came together and made a sound because of the melting ice, and even in that moment, it brought them all together to experience something that kind of bonded them in a way, and it's but it's also one of the elements that was also present, I think, was respect. You know, maybe not in that first situation, but there was a fundamental establishment of respect, and they were not afraid when they came in and they sat down. And so, how to have the commonality and also maintain the respect. Yes, Emmy?
And I just wanted to add that I think having the experience is a really important part. Maybe that was John's part as well.
The common experience was important.
Each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Instead of just having these thoughts in their head, but mm-hmm. here they actually had an experience, which continued to be more experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, Don Hopkins, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Doug. I just wanted to bring up real quickly, actually, a memory I have of being with you going to that men's prison. And it kind of gets back to the beginning of the talk with the comments in that going there, you're going into a place where there's a lot of people that are incarcerated for crimes committed against others, all races and colors. And I never felt any fear going in there. And I was very surprised to find out a couple of things you had mentioned off to the side about maybe what they had done. But the feeling I got from them was that they were brothers and that they were loving people and that they had opened themselves up and were probably remorseful about whatever crime they had committed against others and felt badly and were able to see and try, you know, repent or whatever you want to call it. And mm-hmm. I believe that that exists and could be the case for anybody, but it was something that allowed me to see the good in these people. And it would probably be the opposite for the family of the people or the person that they had committed the crime against to forgive them. Some people can forgive and some can't. If you murdered my kid, I hate you forever. Hope you die. Hope they put you in the electric chair. But I saw the love that seemed to come out of these guys, and it was very encouraging for me. And saw a guy a couple of weeks ago on TV that had been incarcerated for 36 years for a crime he did not commit. And this was an African-American guy, and he finally got set free. And he doesn't have hate. He's just happy to be alive and be out. And so I just think there's a world of different scenarios that take place. But it gets kind of back to your thing about being a bodhisattva and you going into that prison and helping those guys, to me, is a bodhisattva thing, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, the context in which these guys end up there and the lack of vitriol that they have is really surprising. Like you mentioned, of the fellow who was in for 36 years and got out and is not angry. There was a book, Black Like Me, that was written in the early 60s, I think, by a white guy who invested something that made his skin dark. And he didn't tell his family, and he went off and did this experiment. And he remembers one of the incidences was you know, he gets on the bus and he smiles at this white woman because he has, even though his skin is dark now, he has blue eyes, and he looks at this white woman, and the white woman looks back at him and just with hatred, "How dare you look at me like that?" You know, was her response. And here was a guy who a day before was a white guy, and he was already experiencing this. But I wondered if, you know, for some of these racists, if it would be useful for them to take him to a tanning salon, and take your racist friend to a tanning salon and have him get a good dark colored, and then take him out drinking to the spots where they like to drink. And maybe they'd even see their friends and see what kind of reactions happen to them. And I mentioned that maybe this would be an experiment that would be useful for some of us white folk to go through. And I mentioned this to one of my African-American friends, and he said, "Doug, give it up. That will not help." There is so much patience in the Black culture about it, and realize that it just takes time for people's hearts to open and become loving. And love is the only thing that's going to do it. Yep. It's hard to believe sometimes when we're so frustrated that that's all that can do it. But I guess that's it.
Kathy. What about justice? I was reading lately that, you know, some of the bad things that have happened to the Black community happened because they were starting to improve their lot, improve their status, like the Oklahoma massacre, the Tulsa massacre, because they had a whole professional community there. And I know that love is important, but I also believe that equal justice, equal access is the first imperative.
Yes. Yes, when that's where you get back to systems and old systems that have histories that make them hard to be useful anymore because of what their origins are. And there's lots of work to do. One of the encouraging things about all this movement that's happening is just the so many young people of every color, ethnicity, race, all genders, all ages even coming out to express this in this time. It's a very powerful time. And it's not just coming out to express, but all these next steps have to start to happen as well. That as bodhisattvas, that's part of our job too, is to take care of policy. We're taking care of our policy here of turning it to the COVID-19 and how we're going to open, how we're going to function, how are we going to do these things, you know. So policy cuts to the core also of how this is done in an equitable way, and I think there's a lot of smart people looking at that right now. There might be hope. Emmy, you're taking off. Emmy's our Tenzo today, and she's taken off for the kitchen. Well.
Hey, Doug.
Yes, Pamela. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share a story and also tell you how it has affected my practice in this way. And happy Father's Day to all those fathers. And when my first child was born, I was already in my mid-30s, and I remember the day he was born and just this overwhelming, like, epiphany that every baby, every person on the planet started like this. It was, I know it's obvious, right? It's completely obvious. I'd seen puppies born, but still, this baby was in my arms, and I realized that, you know, every incarcerated person, every person I had defended, every person anywhere on the planet started out just like this, this little tiny newborn baby. And any notion for me, you know, maybe it's just all those hormones raging when that happens, but for me, any notion of there being a distinction between me and other people, it just evaporated. It just was gone. I just see everybody all the time as somebody's baby, somebody's baby. And I think it took me almost directly to that cushion in a way, because that's our vow, to see ourselves in others and to see and to let others see us, you know, to kind of forget about any kind of distinction in that way. And it reminds me again of the ceremony and the vows we take, and we walk around each other and we say, Buddha recognizes Buddha, Buddha bows to Buddha. And I want to say that again and again every day of my life. And I hope we're all doing that as we walk around the world, recognizing each other's Buddhahood, I guess.
Yes, beautiful.
Yes.
Well, thank you all for coming. Yusuko, Marcus, Susan, Chris, Michael Schnee, Nico, Cliff, Ben, Ross, Kathy, Karin, Kaveh, Connie, Pamela, and Don Hopkins. So good to see you all. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you, Doug.
Let's do our
close. Thank you, Doug. Our...
Yes, you have a comment, Connie?
Oh, yeah, I just wanted to say thank you. I really enjoyed your talk, and the discussion was really wonderful, too.
Okay. Thank you, Connie. We'll see you Wednesday, right? If not sooner. Good. May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.